Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and the Learning College. Today we're going to resume with Serpent's Walk, Chapter 24. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. It begins, as usual, with a few, this time, shorter epigraphs. First of all, from Leviathan by Thomas Hobbes, he says, "During the time men live without a common power to keep them all in awe, they are in that condition which is called war, and such a war as is of every man against every man. The nature of war consisteth not in actual fighting, but in the known disposition thereto. During all the time there is no assurance to the contrary." And that's the famous war of all against all, and you need a Leviathan and a strong man running things in order to keep that in check. Again, "There never was a good war or a bad peace." Benjamin Franklin. "War is much too serious a thing to be left to the military." Georges Clemenceau. "Der Krieg ist nicht als eine Fortsetzung des politischen Verkehrs mit Einmischung anderer Mittel." Vom Kriege von Karl von Clausewitz. "War is a continuation of politics by other means," and the famous teaching in international relations. Chapter 24, Thursday, February 3rd, 2050. The vid screens showed snow, ash gray rocks, and low undergrowth so dark as to appear black. I should say parenthetically, we're on chapter 24. I believe there are 29 total, so we're into the last quarter. Nothing moved in that landscape. Cadre Lieutenant Arlen Mullet set the mug of steaming coffee down within Lessing's reach and retired. Jennifer Caw had not finished her first cup yet. "They really going to surrender?" she asked. "That's what Gottschalk told me over at our Magellan hookup." "Who?" "Benjamin Gottschalk, the Lib-Rebs commander." Lib-Rebs hyphenated. That's the name of the enemy, of course. "Benjamin Gottschalk, the Lib-Rebs commander. Captain, he calls himself. Used to be an instructor at Stanford. Sociology." Jennifer wriggled on the military cot, rubbed her mittens together, and jammed them into the pockets of her white alpaca ski coat. The lava beds of Northern California were a refrigerator in February. More like the high ranges of the Pacific Northwest than the palm sand and surf of free Calamerica to the south. Remember, the rebels are holed up in California. The cold bit right through the canvas camp chairs, cadre uniforms, and thermal underwear. What a place to die in, like the other side of the moon. Jennifer shook out her auburn locks. She was just passing through and had stopped in at the cadre base camp for a social visit. Spying for Goddard was more like it. That didn't bother Lessing. Better him than somebody less friendly. "Here, Lisa sends these." Jennifer fished into a green leather purse as big as a soldier's knapsack and handed him a vid cassette, a book, and four photographs. Lessing laid the first two items aside and glanced quickly at the pictures. Lisa speaking in an auditorium, their relationship had helped her speech problem. Lisa at the dinner table with Wrench clowning behind her. Lisa in ski togs on Mount Rainier. Lisa and Mulder grinning at the camera like Goldilocks and Papa Pig. Lisa, how he missed her. Outside, something roared hugely, startling them. "A tank revving up," he explained, "in case the Lib-Rebs want to play some more instead of surrendering." The new M90A4 Heston tank was gigantic. The Lib-Rebs had grabbed a few of the monsters to begin with, but now they were down to using antiquated museum pieces such as old M60A3s. The Heston possessed a 120mm gun, two 7.62mm mounted machine guns, an air defense missile launcher, and the latest communications gear, deflectors, rocket confusers, and armor. Some Hestons were equipped with laser cannon as well, but those were all down near newly captured Sacramento, staging for the assault on San Francisco. When that was over, they'd go see about L.A. No tank was much good in the lava beds. The region was crisscrossed with strange little bluffs and ravines, heaped with knife-edged volcanic stones and boulders, and pitted with caves. Mulder, who hailed from Eugene, Oregon, said that this had been the site of an earlier, almost forgotten conflict, the Modoc War of 1873, in which about 160 Indians held off the U.S. Army for months. These days, Captain Jack's refuge was home to a different war party, some 300 ragtag lib-reb guerrillas fighting a rearguard action to delay the U.S. Army's mop-up in Northern California. It had taken weeks of paper wars with the Pentagon, newly refurbished and restocked with bureaucrats, before the generals had agreed to let Lessing's fledgling American Freedom Brigade, the name Outram had chosen, although the unit was closer in size, makeup, and function to a division than a brigade, handle what should have been a minor police action. Like the Modoc War, this took more time and lives than anybody had expected, and the cadre was losing face. Lessing was intent on finishing the job right and correcting the image. Here, the Librebs were all done. Starvation, dysentery, and the worst winter in 50 years had beaten Gottschalk at last. As with the Modocs long ago, bravery was no match for food, weather, and logistics. Lessing sipped his coffee and asked, "How's Mulder, your mother?" "He's fine. She's green light, too. About to marry Grant Simmons. Did you know that?" "The Congress of Americans for Personal Freedom guy?" Lessing had met Simmons. The man was as unmemorable as a ballpark hot dog. It took restraint to keep him from asking, "Why marry him?" "He's a dedicated person, hardworking," Jennifer said, a little defensively. "He's a great speaker. So were some parrots." "Well, congratulations, if that's what I'm supposed to say. Grant's likely to be our candidate for president in 52, you know." "Huh?" He looked up surprised. "What about Outram? Vice President Lee, Mulder himself?" "You haven't heard? Outram's got cancer of the liver. He's likely to die within a few months. Byron Lee's a non-entity." She hesitated. "And Mulder doesn't think he's going to last that long either." "Jesus, he never said anything." "Oh, he's in good shape now, just feeling his age. He wants somebody younger with drive and energy. Somebody who'll consolidate what we've done." Pardon me there. Lessing considered. The party's present bright lights were not very appealing. They were unknown, too young, not charismatic enough, or just too fringe to suit Mr. and Mrs. American public. The party had indeed grown in popularity. You could speak for the movement almost anywhere these days without getting rocks thrown at you, but people like Wrench, Morgan, Goddard, and Abner Hand still weren't the boys next door. Not yet. Lisa and 85 were working on it. Jennifer continued, "People are turning inward, looking to the party to restore our traditional values, our prosperity and identity. Pakov and Starock did more than just kill people. They cut our emotional security from under us. We need somebody solid, committed, rational." "Get Goddard. He's a winner in two out of the three of those categories. You decide which ones." Lessing still couldn't work up an interest in politics. Lisa had tried to involve him, but even she hadn't had much success. He'd rather putter with a car engine, read, play racquetball, or practice with the latest additions to Mulder's arsenal. "Bill has no imagination. I'd rather have Grant Simmons or Byron Lee or you." She let her coat fall open to reveal a forest green sweater, a Navajo necklace of beaten silver set with turquoises, and some spectacular cleavage. He made a wry face. "Me? Come on, Jen." He had already begun to suspect that Jennifer Caw wasn't here just to take in the winter scenery. He had nothing to offer politically, and she knew it. She couldn't have designs on him, could she? Not when she and Lisa were such good friends. Lisa was the jealous type, and as straight-laced about her monogamy as a born-again elder. Nor was he much of a bargain in spite of a good recovery after Palestine and Russia. Yet there was no telling with Jennifer. Wrench called her the mailbox, a public receptacle into which any man can drop his mail. M-A-L-E. A quick roll on the camp cot, then. A morning's jollies, nobody heard, and Lisa never the wiser. Lessing was in no mood to take that risk. Getting close to Lisa had been the hardest thing he'd ever done, and she was worth every angry word, every long wrangle, every drop of sweat, every tear, every long, luxurious morning in bed. He drifted over to inspect the row of vid screens that lined the theater wall of his styroplast hut. How's Borchert doing in Germany? She took the hint with good grace. Hans is fine. Big rally last month in Munich, nearly 100,000. He heard Jennifer stirring her coffee, but he didn't look around. Instead, he bawled, "Hey, Mullet! Arlen!" The aide stuck his head inside the door flap. He kept his eyes averted from the camp cot where Jennifer reclined like Cleopatra cruising the Nile. Skin-tight, black jeans and tooled cowboy boots didn't GI the Egyptian image, but the effect was dramatic nonetheless. "Sir?" Mullet's long, pale, freckled face was as gently bovine as some of his daddy's cows up in the Willamette River Valley. It's up around Portland. He was canny, though, and unexpectedly perceptive. "Where the hell are the librebs? Are we going to have to drag them out after all?" Mullet ruminated. "Detector's just starting to report movement, sir. Coming out real slow, though, cause of the women and kids." "The librebs have their families in there?" Jennifer sat up. "In that icebox?" "The women are mostly fighters," Lessing told her. "There's only a few non-combatants with them. People who are real scared of us. We're supposed to be the racist, fascist beasts, remember?" "There they are now, sir." Mullet lifted his bony chin toward the vid screens. 200-300 in the column, probably all of them. Jennifer came over to see. "No weapons, no uniforms, like a bunch of old ladies on their way to church." "Them old ladies kept us bottled up here for a month," Mullet observed morosely. Lessing was already donning his winter camo greatcoat, mittens, and officer's cap. "Tell Ken Swanson to put it over the amplifiers that I'm coming out to accept their surrender personally." "You, sir?" "Yeah, me. They put up a good fight. Least I can do." "Can I come?" Jennifer used the honeyed tone that usually worked wonders with males. "Not this time." "Uh-uh. No goozy foozy, as the bangers say. Mulder'd unzip me himself if anything happened to you." "I may not have a PhD in academic horse apples like Wrench or Borchert, but I know what makes people tick. Peace is better than war or revenge." Yep, I think I missed a page there. Pardon me just a second. Okay, so he says Mulder would unzip me himself. "He's right, miss." Mullet blocked the doorway. "Carpet mines. A laser at long range. A rocket from ambush. Dangerous." He blinked reproachfully at Lessing. "Even for a so-called experienced merc." "Look," Lessing said to Jennifer, "if you want to help, go over to the field hospital or the mess hall. Show the librebs we're not murdering monsters. They'll need hot coffee, food, and medical care." "Florence Nightingale, me? Oh, all right, but after the atrocities the librebs committed at the Battle of Reading, blame that on their special troops, the L.A. street gangs and their Mexican allies, all the discipline of a pack of rabid dogs." When she said nothing, he added, "If we show the people we're straight, we have a chance to put the country back together again. Screw up, stay disunited, and the Chinese, the Indians, the Turks, the South Americans, somebody will kick our lights out." "They burned down our house in L.A. My mother barely got out alive. They'd have murdered her if they'd caught her." "Forget all that. The future is what matters. Why not use sweetness and light if those will get us friends?" "Oh, we'll win this war militarily, but we really win only if everybody has a chance at the good life. That's what Lisa has Dorn saying these days." "You're naive, Alan. Political realities are different." "I may not have a PhD in academic horse apples like Wrench or Borchert, but I know what makes people tick. Peace is better than war or revenge. The party of humankind, the party is on a roll. Pakov and Starock took out our worst enemies and put Outram in the White House. Otherwise, Mulder would still be peddling fertile grow in India, and you descendants would be piddly shitting around in the sinkholes of the Third World. Luck, lady, pure gubbin luck. The party had better not miss this chance. It's the only one it's likely to get. Nah, even without Pakov, we still would have won. We were on our way, slower, but just as sure. Our North European heritage, our ethnos, our Aryan blood cannot be denied. Look at Germany. She lost two world wars, but she's very much a power again. We come through in the crunch. We don't give up, and we don't die easy. Like the sick cannibal said about the missionary he ate for dinner, you can't keep a good man down. That's awful, and you stole it from Wrench. Who stole it from somebody else? Who stole it from some other gizmo all the way back to the clowns of the Colosseum? Look, Alan, we were working on a long-term economic campaign. That was our strategy, which might have taken another 100 years if it succeeded at all. Better to argue than give her another chance to make moves on him. He said, all I'm saying is that we ought to make amends, compromise, and make peace, provided those things get us whatever we wanted. provided those things get us where we wanted to go in the first place. Hell, I'm the soldier. When there's wars, I'm the guy who has to duck the bullets. Like my dad said, rather finagle than fight. She tilted her head and grinned at him. You know, Alan, you have all the makings of a great libreb. The only thing you haven't figured out yet is the first part of make love, not war. She buttoned her coat and went outside to join Mullet. He followed her into the snow-dusted air. His armored commander stood waiting across what had been the main northern parking lot of the Lava Beds National Monument. Now the tourists and campers and cars and picnic baskets were only memories. Instead, cadre banners flapped fitfully below the stars and stripes over khaki-colored plastic huts, ice-crusted vehicles, and white mounds of tarp-covered stores. Wrench and Morgan had wanted a distinctive cadre flag, like the silver runes on black of the old SS, but Mulder had vetoed it. He had allowed only a white C in the upper left corner of the party's regular flag. That would have to do for now. Lessing stalked across the dirty, hard-packed snow and climbed into the passenger seat beside Stan Crawford, his driver. Mullet came up to gesture and shout, but the engine drowned out his words. Lessing could guess that he wanted to send an escort along. That shouldn't be necessary if Lessing read this Gottschalk right. The Librebs would surrender as promised. On the other hand, if Gottschalk were lying, the shit would get very deep. Lessing thought about it one more time, then waved Mullet away. He wasn't stupid, he wasn't a show-off, and he wasn't particularly brave, but in some odd way he felt himself fated. When his time came, he would go, and not before. Maybe he had some of Islam's kismet, in quotes, destiny, had rubbed off on him in India. The chill of the plastic leather Paradex passenger seat made him wince. The next winter war, the cadre fought, he would see that the cars, the tents, and the toilets had plush seats. Heading, sir? Stan was Ponape trained, tough, 30-ish Carolina. The hell with military jargon. He jerked a thumb and drawled, that away! Snow drifted down in sad little gusts and whirls as they drove, filling in the ruts and potholes with powdered sugar. Captain Jack's MODOK stronghold lay slightly off to the left, with Canby's Cross, Gillen's Camp, and Gillum's Bluff beyond. On their right, much of Tule Lake was once again filled with water as it had been in the MODOK times. The farms and fields of the later settlers were gone, a consequence, Mullet said, of the Viet-Chinese Atomic War of 2010. The locals took this as a sign that Crater Lake up north in Oregon was about to erupt again after a sleep of 6,000 or 8,000 years. Stan spotted the Librebs before he did, a ragged black line against jagged black rocks, black and white like an old movie, a gray sky, a monochrome landscape. He was reminded of one of Mulder's ancient newsreels, German troops trudging through the Russian desolation, leaving equipment and frozen corpses behind as they straggled back toward the crumbling frontiers of the Reich. You want me to drive right up to him? Stan asked, or do we wait here? He glanced around. There's a picnic table, he suggested. We can clean off the snow. Excuse me, but you'll freeze your butt, sir. Standing up in the hatch is better. Say your piece, sit back down, and stay warm. We can put some of their wounded and women folk into our passenger compartment. Good publicity, if you think it's wise. His expression said he did not. Publicity, Wrench's specialty. words and pictures were more important than any military victory he might win. He looked in the rear mirror and caught the glint of a moving silver metallic dome, a Magellan unit keeping pace with them, its cameras grinding away for posterity. Ken Swanson, his corn officer, would have a telephoto holovid cruise up in helicopters as well. He might as well look heroic. He clambered up onto the seat and undogged the ceiling hatch. Ice-tipped wind fingers clawed at his cheeks and forehead as he put his head out. He jerked his cap down and turned up his coat collar. Stan stopped the car, and his ears rang with the sudden stillness. If this had been a movie, any minute they'd hear the Librebs heroically singing their battle song as they marched out to surrender. Lessing grimaced at the fancy. There they were, emerging from among the trees, silent except for the crunch of boots in the snow. Through the binoculars Stan passed up to him, he saw what a tired, hungry, scruffy lot they were. Weaponless, dispirited, dressed in drab civilian clothes, parts of uniforms, and blankets. The one in front must be Gottschalk, a tall, skinny man with frizzy black hair and a beard. Beside him was a dark, hatchet-beaked woman who carried a quilt-wrapped infant and herded five older children along before her. Lessing counted two boys and three girls, perhaps 7 to 12 years of age. The smallest girl bore a bundle. No, it was a teddy bear, nearly as big as she was. The others in the vanguard were adults. Soldiers, would-be soldiers, and play soldiers, caught up in a reality they had never expected. He tried the bullhorn. "Hey, attention!" That wasn't very eloquent. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw the Magellan recording the scene. "You rebels," he called more loudly. "I'm the Cadre Colonel Alan Lessing of the American Freedom Brigade, United States Army." "Pog yourself, bastard!" a voice from the column squawked back. Others made more pungent suggestions. "Look, if you'd rather fight some more, we'll oblige. Send out your non-combatants and let's go to it." Gottschalk, the skinny man, yelled at his troops for quiet. To Lessing he said, "You know what we're here for, Colonel. No food, out of ammo, and colder than a bitch. We need medical treatment for our wounded. 15 men, 3 women, and a frostbitten kid." "Yes, sure. I'll call for ambulances. No need for your injured to walk the rest of the way." He passed the order to Stan. Gottschalk's woman sat down on a boulder, the children in a defensive ring around her, the others standing or squatting where they were. The Libreb leader himself came over to the commander. "A fine end for a Stanford PhD," Gottschalk said. Stan kept their mounted machine gun trained on him. "You're not ended yet." "I get a fair trial? A jury? My civil rights? Then you hang me? Sorry, we aren't into hangings." We all just disappear, is that it? Death squad style, or maybe a shower bath that is really a gas chamber?" "That's crap," Lessing answered tiredly. "You and your people in a revolt against the legally elected constitutional government of the United States of America? That's treason. What do you expect from us? Cheers? A peace prize? So what does happen?" "You get sent to a reorientation camp near Seattle. If we like you, and you like us, you go back to being ordinary Americans. If you can't or won't fit in, you lose your citizenship. Then you move to any country that'll take you." "Exile? You've got to be kidding." Lessing smiled at the antiquated turn of a phrase. "Nope. Go wherever you're wanted. If you're a communist, you can live happily ever after in whatever's left of the People's Republic of China. They need workers to build their Marxist paradise. Blacks have a choice of 16 settlements in Africa, a half dozen Caribbean islands, or one of the black majority nations in South America. Jews are welcome in the Izzy colonies in Russia. They're looking for skilled, educated people to build a new chosen people. Jews only, religious, racist, Eretz Israel there. As for Southeast Asians and Latins, they can go back to their native lands as soon as the war is over. Any other unreconstructed Librebs of whatever persuasion go to whoever lets them in, the communes in Russia, our own settlements around the oil fields in the Persian Gulf, Europe, Australia, Canada, wherever. If nobody wants you, we'll set up some sort of isolated enclave for you here, where you can do your own thing by yourselves. Lies, the woman interrupted in a sharp, fierce voice. Another holocaust, a free ticket to the gas chambers. Sorry, no gas chambers. Resettlement abroad, like Germany before World War II, though that's not how you people want it remembered. Take your families and go. Lessing was too cold to wrangle. He could no longer feel his ears, and his forehead ached. He rubbed at the bridge of his nose. The woman got unsteadily to her feet. Stan's machine gun swiveled to track her. Why should we go? Why us? We've contributed so much to this country. Doctors, lawyers, musicians, scientists, artists, every profession, every walk of life. We won't go. It's you, you poggin' fascist, who ought to go. You're not Americans. You don't belong. Wrong. We are the majority. We've been a silent majority for too long. Now we're taking control. We, the American majority, say that you don't fit. We don't want your music, your art, your science. We've got our own, and we're satisfied. We can't assimilate you, and we won't let you run us. So you go. No argument, no discussion, no high-buck lawyers. His cheeks were numb in the bitter wind. I promise you decent treatment, no gas chambers, and no concentration camps. We'll treat you a hell of a lot better than you would have done us. He shut off his mind. Wrench had given him a list of things to say for the benefit of TV cameras, and he said them without enthusiasm, without caring whether he believed them or not. For all he knew, the camp up near Seattle might offer a full complement of gas chambers, ovens, torture machines, and sadoporn queens dressed in black leather and waving whips. It might, but he didn't think so. He had come to trust Mulder, Lisa, and Wrench, at least. It would be stupid to lie to him. Moreover, he'd find out, and then he would become an enemy. Alan Lessing did not let people lie to him. The ambulances are here, Stan called up to him. The Dinkers scan. Move their These Dinkers can move their wounded into that clearing for pickup. The return trip was a triumphal procession. Lessing didn't like it, but he understood. Sterok's victims had no more worries. It was the survivors who suffered, mourned, and endured shortages and social upheavals and woke sweating from nightmares of invisible death. They needed good news. Morale was the object here. Lessing resigned himself to being a military hero. He took Wrench's advice, patched in over their radio to HomeNet headquarters in Kansas City, and rode into camp standing up in the hatch like a panzer commander on parade. Too bad he hadn't brought tanker goggles to go with his peak cap. There was no martial music either, just the soughing of the wind high up in the evergreens, a dirge to the dead. Wrench could add suitable oom-papa to the broadcast, together with wild cheering and play-by-play commentary. The mess hall and hospital were both housed in a big, barn-like garage the National Park Service had built for its maintenance vehicles back during the era of the born-agains. They had done a good job with parks and historical monuments, but the administrations that followed were too preoccupied with the Middle East, pollution, farm riots, labor unrest, and the national debt, the failure of Social Security and Medicare, and getting stroked by their PAC to pay attention to lesser matters. Lessing met Mullen and Jennifer at the door, greeted Timothy Helm, his second-in-command, and waved away the bundle of dispatches Ken Swanson pushed at him. First things first, the Libreb wounded had to be admitted into the hospital. Those suffering from minor frostbite and injuries were lined up to await their turns, and the rest were shepherded into the mess hall, where Lessing's staff searched and processed them before sending them on to the cafeteria. Some slumped down at the tables without eating. Others had to be warned against gobbling too much too fast. The room stank of unwashed bodies, wet wool, and cooking. The combination was not unpleasant. It reminded Lessing of noon recess in his grade school lunchroom during winters in Iowa long ago. He sat down at one of the tables and accepted a bowl of lumpy gray chicken soup from Jennifer. He still had a headache, but now he could blame it on the stuffy, overheated room instead of the cold outside. The soup helped. Mullet laid a roll of maps captured from the rebel stronghold beside his plate and announced that Tim Helm wanted to discuss them. Swanson was also hovering nearby, clutching his dispatches and picking his nose. Did it have to be a universal truth that corn men were invariably nose pickers? You guys checking for holdouts? Lessing asked of Helm. Snipers? Nobody. We got hoppy choppers flying in search circles back into the beds, but some of them lib-reb smartasses got deflector blankets that block heat sensors and plastic weapons that don't trigger our search beams. There's miles of lava caves down south by Indian Well, too. A guy could hide anywhere. We'll get most of them sooner or later, though, and any we miss will freeze their yarbles off. Oh, we scanned the prisoners you brought in. They're clean. See you when you're done. He scooped up his maps and left. Lessing ate soup, methodically and without interest. By now, Homenet would be telling the world of his splendid victory, this feat of personal valor, this great step forward for the forces of righteousness. Home, mother, and apple pie. The heat was making him drowsy. He needed Lisa. You missed at it? A voice impinged muzzily upon his thoughts. He opened his eyes and saw a little girl, the one with the teddy bear. What? The clash and clatter of cutlery made it hard to understand her. Miss Dadette! You, Miss Dadette! The child wiped her nose with grubby fingers. She wore a dress made from a patchwork quilt, and her feet were shapeless blobs of U.S. Army sacking and burlap. Mullet laughed. She's asking if you're Mr. Death, sir. He pointed to the black uniform and silver insignia wrench designed for the cadre officers. The troops still wore U.S. Army camo. She held out the stained brown plush teddy bear. Uncle Jesse said to show teen to Mr. Dett. That's nice, but I'm not... Oh, the hell with it. The girl plucked at a plastic ring at the back of the bear's furry head. Teen talks, you know. Dandy. Now he would be treated to a bad tape of Cuddle Me, Mommy. Lessing had never had much to do with kids, but he could sympathize with this one. It wasn't her fault she was here. Another little girl flickered against the shadow curtain of his memory, a silent and pitiful creature in the back of some sort of vehicle. Was she a dream? It seemed so very far away. He heard sobbing and felt her stick-like body in his arms. The bear spoke. In a raffish British accent, it said, "Hello, Lessing. Teen here. Remember me? Jason Hollister?" Marvelous gap. God almighty. His combat reflexes were still good. He grabbed the bear out of the child's hands, looked wildly around, howled a warning, slung the toy toward the soup cauldrons in the emptiest part of the mess hall, and dived over on top of the little girl. Chairs screeched and skidded as they tumbled together in a heap under the table. The thunderclap of the explosion snatched away all the sound, all hearing, all breath, and all sensation. Crockery and cutlery became shrapnel. Hot soup turned into fiery napalm. Pots and pans flew like cannonballs. Not only did the teddy bear contain an explosive charge, but it was stuffed with undetectable caltrops. Sharp, four-pointed stars of brittle plastic that shrieked away in every direction, slashing whatever lay in their paths. Seconds passed before the screaming began. Lessing lay sprawled on top of the girl. The tabletop collapsed over both of them. He didn't know if he was hurt. The bomb had landed behind the serving counter, limiting the direct force of its blast. The caltrops had caused most of the damage. In his mind's eye, he saw the people behind the counter again, two or three prisoners taking seconds, four or five guards, and a cluster of kitchen help over by the coffee urns. They were all dead now. He had killed them. Yet what could he have done? The rest of the room was packed. Dozens would have died if he had thrown the damn bear anywhere else. Nor could he have rushed over and dunked the bomb into a soup pot. Modern demo devices were waterproof. The child wriggled and moaned. It was when he sought to roll away from her he found that he was injured. How badly, he wasn't sure. They lay in a puddle of red, and he knew instinctively that it was his blood, not hers. His left arm didn't work, and something was wrong with his face. He explored with his tongue and encountered only air. His left cheek was either torn wide open or gone. Both eyes still functioned, though the left one was blurred. The strange thing was that he didn't hurt. He had no sensation at all. To his further surprise, his headache was gone. We couldn't, it wasn't us, someone kept moaning above him. It sounded like Gottschalk. Feet stamped on the tabletop over his legs. That hurt, and he cried out. The table lifted up, and went away, giving him a view of the jagged, blackened hole in the cinder blocks of the far wall where the cafeteria counter had been. Snow was already sifting in to hide the carnage. Gottschalk's harpy was on top of him, pawing, digging, trying to get at the child. The rebel leader himself was visible behind her, his beard and shirt spattered with red. The woman shoved roughly at Lessing, cursing him, and dragged the limp, dirt-blackened child out. She cradled her and crooned to her, then rose and lurched away. The pain was beginning now. Soon it would be agony if he didn't bleed to death first. The Librebs were innocent this time. They had died here just as Lessing's people had. Jason Hollister, or Teen, from the Marvelous Gap spec shop, had given the teddy bear to the kid. Lessing hadn't seen Hollister among the prisoners, which meant he had already left before the surrender. Right now, the bastard was probably watching his bloody triumph on HomeNet in some Roach Heaven motel in San Francisco. Automatic weapons fire chattered. Screams and shots echoed back and forth in the chaos, and he smelled smoke. So much for good publicity. A woman shrieked and kept on shrieking. Lessing wondered if it were Gottschalk's witch, or could it be Jennifer? He went to sleep, shooting or no shooting. Much, much later, he awoke from a lazy afternoon in the movies with Emily Pietrick. Their own love scene had been as much juicier than the one on the screen. Now he was both bored and horny again. Without warning, the fabric of that universe ripped apart, and he heard someone say, "He may need a transplant for the eye. Got one in stock?" A second voice mumbled, "Yeah, think so, up in Klamath Falls." "Get it here, just in case. It's the arm that'll be tough, though." Caltrop ripped down through his cheek and into his shoulder. Lots of damage. "What's his blood type?" "On his dog tag, Doc." Fingers fumbled at his throat. "Urn. Get him a stretcher and prep him for immediate ops. The Libreb woman's dead, though. Need a body bag for her. Her husband, too. Christ, our guys went nuts with the automatics." "Serves the poggers right. It was their fucking bomb. How's the kid Colonel landed on? Scared out of her weenies, but okay. What a gubbin mess." He went back into the theater to find Emily. Maybe the movie would be better the second time around. "You ask whether the Party of Humankind has a solution for the crime problem. Thank you, young lady. The answer is yes. Now, let's see. Okay, so a bit about the crime problem is the start to a very, very long epigraph for chapter 25. So chapter 24 ends with him basically going back to sleep and dreaming of Emily Pietrick again, being very injured after the bomb. So that will do it for chapter 24 of Randolph O. Calverhall's Serpent's Walk. Thank you for being with me, Alex Linder, today again. Find this at vnnforum.com. Everything we record is part of our Learning College audiobook series, which will eventually encompass all of the top 200 most significant Jew-critical pro-white books that have ever been written, as well as other, we'll go beyond 200, we'll include other stuff, but the main goal is to get the top Jew books necessary to understand the true context in which we live, and that will always be at vnnforum.com, and eventually we also archive stuff at alexlinder.com. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon, and we'll pick up with the final few chapters from Serpent's Walk.